We're seeing a rapid rise in the cumulative number of positive COVID-19 cases, indicating that, as we had expected, we are approaching a surge during the latter winter months of July and August. Now, it's widely predicted that within the coming days, Gauteng will emerge with the highest COVID-19 numbers, and so the race for a vaccine is becoming increasingly urgent. Vaccinology has repeatedly held the future health of humanity in its hands. The specialist branch of medicine has historically been called on to save lives through the clinical formulation of a vaccine for diseases such as polio, measles and TB, and a multitude of other conditions that have seen an effective response from the scientific community. Now this week we go to the front lines of this field of research with Director of the Vaccines and Infectious Diseases Analytical Unit, VIDA, that's in the Faculty of Health Sciences at WITS, a man who works intensively in the field and is poised to contribute at a time when a vaccine for the novel SARS-CoV-2 virus or COVID-19 is being sought. As Department of Science and Technology and National Research Foundation Research Chair in Vaccine Preventable Diseases at WITS, Professor Shabir Ahmed Mahdi focuses on addressing the leading infectious diseases causes of morbidity and mortality, including vaccine-preventable diseases, HIV and TB. He served as the immediate past director of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases from 2011 to 2017 and currently serves as the chair of the National Advisory Group on Immunization in South Africa. Welcome to the show, Professor Mahdi. You're also co-founder and co-director of the African Leadership Initiative for Vaccinology Expertise Alive, and having completed your undergrad and postgrad training at WITS, qualifying as a pediatrician in 96 and obtaining your PhD in 2003. It was recently announced that you will take over from the Dean of Health Services, Professor Martin Vella, whose contract ends in December. So well done, firstly, and fair to say that you have WITS in your blood. So I've got to start with a WITS question. Your thoughts on the tenure of outgoing VC Adam Habib and incoming VC Zeblon Vilakazi?
Yeah, so I think Adam has really done a marvelous job in terms of making WITS much more competitive when it comes to research, especially. But at the same time, I think he's had a really difficult period. Obviously, he was in the midst of the Fees Must Fall campaign. And I think the University of Witwatersrand, like many other higher institutions in South Africa, are very much still in a transitional phase from what was prevalent during apartheid years. And even though we're almost 25 years into our democracy, that transition doesn't take place overnight. It's really a transition that probably requires 2 to 3 generations for it to be fully accomplished. So I think Adam has really done a great job, and Zeblon has obviously got the benefits of having worked in the institution in a different capacity, but he's very familiar in terms of what the challenges are. And I think in terms of continuity, it's really important for a university if we are wanting to accomplish our sort of vision of being a world-class, of remaining a world-class institution in the world, a world-class institution.
Now, there are some dire warnings in the Sunday papers and all this week, in fact, about rapidly rising infections. It seems that R number is really growing in Gauteng in particular. But I asked some family and friends what the daily increase data in the province looks like, how many total infections, how many new infections daily, and they couldn't tell me. So is fatigue setting in? Is that the big fear right now as the wave breaks over us?
So, Michael, I think we face a number of challenges in terms of being adequately able to quantify where we are with the outbreak. Part of it is related to fatigue, but the other big component of it is that the testing strategy has always been sort of a moving target, in that there hasn't been any stability in terms of what threshold we use to test people, what indications are, and as well as the around issues related to the turnaround time. So that makes it really difficult to interpret the type of data that is put forward on a daily basis. As an example, you mentioned, the majority of new cases are now being diagnosed in Gauteng, which is true in terms of what is reported. But at the same time, what's happened in the Western Cape is that they've changed they've reprioritized as to who they're testing. So their focus right now is the testing of individuals that are hospitalized, rather than what they were previously doing, which was targeting what was considered to be hotspots. So it's really difficult to make any head-to-head comparisons between provinces, and even more so between countries. In fact, it's a futile exercise to make any sort of comparison between South Africa and any other country, because our testing strategy, the rate of testing, just differs so much that it's impossible to make any sort of meaningful interpretation. Where are we in South Africa? The Western Cape hasn't peaked as yet, to start off with. But the Western Cape at the same time is probably yet in terms of this particular outbreak of the pandemic by about 3 to 4 weeks compared to where we are in Gauteng. So right now in Gauteng, as you mentioned, there's an escalation in terms of number of new cases reported on a daily basis. But again, we're still not anywhere close to the peak. And what we really need to interrogate more closely to understand exactly when we peak is patterns in terms of hospitalization, which is sort of a much more standardized measure to use to determine what exactly is the doubling time, as well as when we start seeing a decline, both in terms of number of hospitalizations, as well as a decline in terms of number of people that are reported to have died of COVID-19.
And that's why when we look at things like effective deaths as well, that's such a useful measure. And you're on record recently as saying they're likely to be a factor of 10 times more people infected. And to the points you raised around testing, we just won't know because of those testing issues. Now, you're leading the South African OX1 COVID-19 vaccine VIDA trial. Firstly, why do the trials in South Africa, if the race is on globally, and we seem quite far behind the pack already?
So I think, fortunately, when it comes to the COVID vaccine 19 studies, we're pretty much up there in the pack in terms of being involved in the clinical development of this vaccine, which is perhaps the most, the furthest in terms of where it is when it comes to clinical development. So the COVID vaccine that was developed by the University of Oxford is going into phase 2 and phase 3 studies. There's about 11 other vaccines that are in humans that are being evaluated in humans now, of which one in China has gone into phase 3, but the rest of them are still at a very early stage of clinical development. So certainly South Africa's involvement in terms of COVID-19 vaccines is pretty competitive. And like we've mentioned, it's the first country on the African continent. The question is, how important is it for us to be doing the studies in South Africa if it's being done elsewhere? And the answer to that is that it's of utmost importance. If we are wanting to understand how these vaccines work in our own context, with our own sort of issues related to differences in demographic profile, differences in prevalence of comorbidities, as well as in relation to HIV, we need to get evidence from the local context to be able to determine what the public health value of these vaccines are. The legacy of vaccines is that when the clinical development and evaluation of the vaccines hasn't taken place timelessly in low middle income countries, there's been anything up to a 5 to 20 year lag between when the vaccine is introduced in high income countries and when it becomes available in low middle income countries. And much of that is because of the lack of information in terms of just how well these vaccines are going to perform. So if we are wanting to gain early access to this vaccine, and if we want to make an informed decision as to whether these vaccines are going to be of benefit in a local context, it's essential that we actually be involved right at this early stage in terms of its clinical development.
And therefore, there's a lot to be proud of as well. What are the timelines of the study and the development of the vaccine and the actual process of doing a clinical trial on a COVID-19 vaccine?
So the timelines of that we're embarking on in terms of development of a COVID-19 vaccine is sort of the exception rather than a rule. Usually it takes anything between 5 to 15 years from the time a vaccine is developed in a lab to the time it actually becomes licensed. What we're looking is trying to condense that to a period of 18 months or 2 years at the most. So it's definitely a much more accelerated timeline. In terms of what we're doing currently, based as to when we'll get an answer, unfortunately, where we are in South Africa is because of the high force of infection that's currently taking place. We're probably going to end up getting an answer much sooner than later, which is good for a study, but it's not good for what's happening in South Africa, obviously.
Yeah.
So the plan initially was that by enrolling about 2,000 volunteers over a period of about 6 to 8 weeks, we would probably be able to get an answer sometime early next year. But like I said, unfortunately, because of the high rate of infection, it's very likely that we'll know by the end of November as to whether this vaccine works in South Africa or not.
Very interesting. Who then develops licenses and actually produces the vaccine?
So this vaccine was developed by the Jenner Institute, which is linked to the University of Oxford. And University of Oxford have subsequently actually entered into a partnership with AstraZeneca, who will be the eventual producers of the vaccine. The study in South Africa is not being funded by AstraZeneca. It's got the completely different source of funding. An agreement with University of Oxford to do the study in South Africa preceded the agreement with AstraZeneca. So moving forward, if this vaccine is shown to actually work, the producers of the manufacturers of the vaccine would be AstraZeneca, and they're already going out at risk in terms of developing the plants to be able to produce millions of doses of vaccine, not knowing whether the vaccine will eventually work or not. In addition to AstraZeneca, for this particular vaccine, there are other initiatives underway to actually get companies in low middle income countries to partner to produce a vaccine. And one of those companies is the Serum Institute of in India, which basically has got a huge record of providing vaccines for low middle income countries. Even the usual childhood vaccines that are provided in many low middle income countries comes from Serum Institute. So AstraZeneca and Serum Institute are also in discussions in terms of being able to scale up the volume, the quantity of vaccines that can be produced over a short period of time. So that is where this vaccine is heading towards in the next few months.
And that's obviously the important next step here, because there's obviously a big political element to this around who gets access to that vaccine once it's been developed. And you've already answered one part of that question by saying at least we've got the data to support a rollout of the vaccine in South Africa. I suppose the next question is whether or not that vaccine is going to be made available in terms of production timeously. What is your sense and feeling with having worked on trials like this in the past? We're seeing an estimated date, depending on which trial you look at, of around September next year for the global production of a vaccine. When do you see this vaccine actually hitting the streets in South Africa?
Well, it's difficult to say when it's going to hit the streets of South Africa, and I would hope that it would be sometime during the course of next year if we show that the vaccine actually works in South Africa. But there's a number of factors at play. As you correctly pointed out, as an example, this particular vaccine, the US government has already purchased the vaccine in advance of it actually being shown to work. So they've already, I think, put up $300 million as a pre-purchase for this particular vaccine, in addition to purchases which they're making for other vaccines. So there's going to need to be some active engagement of governments as well as of the World Health Organization, Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. And that sort of engagement with pharma needs to take place now, so that we don't end up having these COVID-19 vaccines introduced in Africa, including South Africa, after the pandemic has passed, which is very much what happened in 2009 with the swine flu. Because government wasn't actively engaged, because all of the role players weren't actively engaged, we ended up getting the swine flu vaccine pretty much after that pandemic had actually passed us, and we can't afford for that to happen. So what we're doing is one bit of a contribution in terms of making the case as to why these vaccines should become available sooner rather than later in the African context.
How are the participants selected for the study?
So participation in the study is completely voluntary. And what we've done is that we've sort of sent out messages using various platforms to ask people to come forward if they are interested. If they do come forward, then they undergo a screening process, because we've got certain criteria which need to be met to make someone eligible to participate in the study. To start off with, as an example, they need to be between the age of 18 and 65, they can't be pregnant. And for the bulk of the study, we're focusing it on people that are not infected with HIV. They then go through a screening process. We do some additional blood sampling to ensure that they meet certain criteria. And once they establish to actually conform to the eligibility criteria, they then randomly allocated to one of two groups. And neither the participants nor the investigators know which participant is allocated to which group, because that's important in terms of not being biased when doing an evaluation, both of the safety of the vaccine as well as trying to determine whether it actually works or not in preventing COVID-19. So that randomization takes place, and then they would be followed up almost every 2 weeks. We've been in constant contact with them to determine whether they're manifesting any symptoms of COVID-19. And even in the interim period, if they are, they would come to the clinic to be investigated for COVID-19. So over a period of time, what we're needing to do is have roughly about 42 participants develop COVID-19 before we'd be able to make a determination as to whether this vaccine protects against COVID-19 or not.
And when we look at the development of this pandemic, how will it develop with or without the vaccine? Because over the last weeks, There's been a substantial amount of new evidence becoming available about immunity to SARS-CoV-2. And often this information, I think, for the public is difficult to process and integrate and understand. We talk about things like herd immunity. We test for antibodies. There's a T cell immunity as well. How do you see all of this developing when it comes to humanity developing some kind of herd immunity?
So, Michael, I think a good starting point is what is herd immunity? And what herd immunity really refers to is that a certain percentage of the population have developed immunity. And consequently, even if they're exposed to the virus, they're not going to transmit it onto someone else. So there's sort of a break in terms of the chains of transmission. Now, for SARS coronavirus 2, there's sort of differences in opinion as to exactly what percentage of the population needs to establish long-lasting immunity. And the operative word is the long-lasting immunity. And that percentage is anything between 40 to 60%. Previously, we said 60%. More recent data indicates that even roughly at about 40%, you probably would get herd immunity kick in. Now, the problem with natural infection is that there's a number of unknowns in terms of the durability of protection. In addition to which, what we've seen happen is that there's differences in terms of the robustness of the immune response depending on the severity of the illness. So as an example, one out of every two people that are infected with this virus will be completely asymptomatic. And even of those that are symptomatic, the majority will have mild symptoms. Those individuals, unfortunately, appear to be mounting a less robust immune response than people that end up in hospitals. So that's the first part. Then in terms of the duration of immunity, when we're just looking at antibody, it seems that antibody starts waning after 2 to 3 months after natural infection. So that is of concern, but it doesn't necessarily exclude that there's underlying immunity, because you mentioned this whole issue of T cells. So there's something called memory responses, which is usually induced when you're exposed to a germ or by vaccines. So there might be underlying memory responses which are not necessarily reflected in the absence of antibody. But these are a number of unknowns with natural infection as to whether there's going to be durability in terms of protection, in terms of the memory responses, as well as how robust that immune response. And that's the reason why we're really hedging our bets with a vaccine, because vaccines are somewhat much more predictable in terms of the immune response, as well as the memory response which it's able to induce. So to get to that 40 to 60% mark, it might happen with natural infection, but vaccines can accelerate the timeline and probably provide greater security that immunity is longer lasting.
And I say this because there was a very interesting article in the BBC that immunity may be more widespread than tests suggest. And governments around the world are testing citizens for coronavirus antibodies to work out whether people obviously have had COVID-19. And some countries are setting up so-called immunity passports, and others may follow suit. And the idea is that a passport would certify that you've had coronavirus and won't carry or contract the disease again, which will open up a way out of lockdown restrictions for the holder. But is that theory correct?
Well, unfortunately not, and certainly not the type of antibody tests that are being used currently. It does determine whether someone has been exposed, but it tells you very little in terms of whether the type of exposure has actually induced immunity that protects against COVID-19. So it's actually misleading, and I think most people would actually reject it as a manner of determining whether someone remains a potential transmitter of the virus. So the sort of immunity passports, I don't think is of much use, but there is a role for this antibody testing, as you correctly pointed out. It allows us to be able to quantify what percentage of the population have been infected. So as an example, in New York, they've established that roughly about 23% of the population in New York City have been infected with the virus, despite the numbers of people that were diagnosed with COVID-19 not being more than 10% of that 23% of the population that were infected. So it allows you to give some sort of an idea in terms of the extent of exposure that's already occurred, the number of people that have been infected. And eventually, when we get a better understanding in terms of what the actual mediators, immune mediators are that predict protection, we'll be able to sort of get some reconciliation between using this rapid antibody test and what it actually means in terms of whether the person is actually protected and not affecting in terms of possibly transmitting the virus.
And on the issue of testing, there was an emphasis by the World Health Organization on testing to understand the epidemic, but we've had limitations, as we touched on. There's a lack of reagents, there's backlogs. Just yesterday I saw the note from the Lancet that they've exceeded capacity, and the community spread is now significant. How do we monitor this pandemic to ensure that our health system isn't overwhelmed now that we have these testing issues?
So the testing strategy should have been reworked a few weeks ago already, because we've been having these problems chronically now. And it's really about what is the best value that you're going to get for the limited tests that you've got available. And doing testing in a community is really a good to have right now in the context of our limited ability to test. And in fact, turnaround time of testing that's being done in a community makes it almost futile, because by the time a person is getting a result back 5 to 7 days later, in fact, they're no longer infectious. So we need the testing to be prioritized for people that are being hospitalized. So it allows healthcare workers to triage patients and to manage the patients. In addition to which, we also need testing to be made available to healthcare workers in the facilities. And that's really important for two reasons. Firstly, it assists us in terms of determining just how many healthcare workers are getting infected. But more importantly, it prevents those healthcare workers that are infected from passing it on to other healthcare workers, as well as to other patients in the hospital that might not be infected with COVID and that have been hospitalized for other reasons. So there needs to be a complete prioritization. In fact, right now, in my opinion, there should be absolutely no community testing. There should only be hospital-based testing and testing in outbreak situations in facilities outside of the hospital. And that is as much as our testing actually allows us to do. And it wouldn't be a huge departure from what was happening in the United Kingdom at the peak as well. The United Kingdom were not testing in a community. If people are symptomatic at this stage of the epidemic, they need to assume themselves to be infected. There comes a threshold where you basically, it becomes one out of every two people that have been screened that are symptomatic test positive. It's not of much value to continue testing under that context. So people should assume themselves as being infected. And further down the line, we can do a rapid antibody test to confirm whether they were infected. That's not going to help us to determine how to manage them, but it gives us a sense in terms of the number of people that were infected.
And they're very similar to what the Western Cape has done in pivoting its testing strategy. Gauteng may reinstate area-specific lockdowns, further regulations on alcohol sales, and slow down the reopening of schools. In fact, we've seen that nationally. These seem to be very drastic measures, considering that the community spread is so virulent at this stage, and obviously could deliver a big blow to an economy in the midst of its worst crisis in about a century. Now, you've been vocally critical of the extended hard lockdown. What do you think of the decision to potentially lock down again in Gauteng?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I don't think it's going to add any value. All that it will do is that it will push this epidemic into the future. So if we lock down for 3 to 4 weeks now, we might not reach a peak in 3 to 4 weeks, but we're going to reach that same peak in another 3 to 4 weeks. I think the initial level 5 lockdown has a number of reasons behind it, one of which was to better prepare our healthcare facilities. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to do that now, almost 100 days since that level 5 lockdown was actually implemented. I can't see us being able to do it in the next 3 to 4 weeks. A lockdown on its own simply does not eliminate the virus in any place, in any country in the world. It's never eliminated the virus. It needs to be coupled with a very effective testing strategy, which we didn't have in place during our initial level 5 lockdown, which we still don't have in place, and where there's no opportunity for that sort of a testing strategy to be put into place, given the limitations around testing in the country. So a level 5 lockdown, going back to a level 5 lockdown, is just delaying the inevitable. That is the bottom line. And the only thing that is going to assist us right now, and it's easier said than done, is the behavior of the populace. The reason why this virus is rampant in terms of transmission is because people in Gauteng and many other parts of the country are simply not adhering to the non-pharmaceutical interventions, and that is not the closure of schools. In fact, school closure has got a nominal effect in terms of transmission of this particular virus. It's only been shown, it's been modeled, that it won't increase the transmission by more than 2 to 4%, as compared to the wearing of non-surgical face masks, as compared to physical distancing. Those are much more powerful tools in terms of reducing the rate of transmission of this virus. And that is really the only thing that we've got available to us. We do not have lockdown, in my opinion, as a strategy to be able to mitigate the effects of this virus. If anything, going back into a level 5 lockdown is going to worsen the health situation in this country at a number of fronts. And when we talk of the COVID response, we need to understand what the indirect consequences of that COVID response has been. And there's emerging data in South Africa which shows that children have been 25% less likely to be immunized against life-threatening diseases during the period of the lockdown. People have been less likely to be tested for TB, and there's been a 1/3 reduction in the number of people that have been diagnosed with tuberculosis during the level 5 period of the lockdown. Those TB didn't cure, the lockdown didn't get rid of TB. Those people are being delayed in terms of diagnosis, they've been delayed in terms of initiation of treatment, their outcome is going to be poorer. So there's a number of consequences just on a health front, let alone the economy.
Absolutely.
And society as a whole.
And those are not insignificant unintended consequences. And to your point, we need to focus all of our energy, therefore, on how we change behavior, on how we reinforce the messaging around those non-pharmaceutical interventions of mask wearing, physical distancing, and washing of hands. Professor, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time and for all the work that you're doing on the front lines.